George MacDonald wrote a book one time about a pastor who was coming to realize or didn't know whether they believed in anything spiritual anymore. That's a dilemma. And the book tells of the pastor's journey back towards God, and toward the end of the book, the pastor befriends a young man who has a terminal illness. He befriends him, he begins to care for him, and of course they converse, and the young man knows about the pastor's doubts. And in the final conversations, the young man asked the pastor again about his faith in God. He said, "Are you any surer about him than you used to be?" And the pastor said, "At least I hope in him far more." And the young man said, "Is that enough?" And the pastor said, "No, I want more." And the young man told him, "I really wish that I could come back from the grave so that you could know for sure that God exists." And the pastor responded that even if such a thing were possible, he would not wish for it, that he did not want to know for sure 1 minute before God wanted him to know. He said he would prefer to obtain the good of not knowing. Interesting. Think about that phrase for a minute, the good of not knowing. When is it good to not know? Christmas presents, surprise party. But even then, when is it good to not know? Genesis 2, passage we're familiar with, know that story pretty well. But the way we tell that story a lot of times, little attention is given to Adam and Eve's vocation and calling. And think about it. They are put as high priest in God's cosmic temple. Like their calling is, you are to shepherd the world and bring from this palette that I've created its full potential. It's a big calling. They're given this gift of permission. But the way we tell the story, the way we read that sometimes in Genesis 2 is God is the one who prohibits. Like there is this one limitation, but you think that is hardly a burden in light of all the good gifts that are being shared here in this passage. Think of the situation here with Adam and Eve. Created to interact with God, to walk with God, to dwell peacefully with the divine presence. Think of their relationship. This couple has no guilt, right? There's no self-centeredness. There's no shame. There's no sense of being anything other than what they were created to be. Neither one of them viewed the other as a rival or as some kind of competition to their existence. They were at ease with one another. And just imagine there is this state of intimacy. Humankind also is at peace with the environment around it, this abundant provision of all these things good. Now, friends, that there is what we long for. Like, that is God's intentions. That was his plan. That is his dream for the world. And when you get down to people's addictions, that's what we're after. We're pining after the garden and trying to get back there. But there's this tree issue. Just notice, though, again, God's first words are of place, of gifts, of the permission that they have, right? His second word is a word about, yes, limitations and boundaries. There's a hierarchy, and there's harmony in that hierarchy, right? There's God, there's men and women as the face of God to the world, and then there is the world. And there's harmony there. When those get out of order, you now have the source of addiction. Because physical things are put higher, and that's where we find happiness, you see? So there's this beautiful harmony in the way that it is set up, and trusting that this good creator has our best interests in mind. So what do we have in that story? Well, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That is the one thing that is forbidden. You say, what is going on there? Well, good and evil in the scripture, when it does that, it's called a mirrorism It's revealing a whole range of knowledge that relates to good and evil. So it's like all this knowledge that relates to good and evil. So the tree is going to be a tool that God uses to teach humankind to distinguish right from wrong and good from evil. Now think of this. The knowledge is going to come through Adam's response to this tree. See? Either he is going to say, yeah, I think what God has said is correct, so he's going to obey and trust, or he's going to take matters into his own hand, autonomy. See? The knowledge isn't bad. The knowledge isn't forbidden, Adam. The question is, how is Adam going to get this knowledge? He's going to gain knowledge by means of this tree. So again, tree isn't sinful. Knowledge isn't sinful. God possesses that knowledge. Adam and Eve are going to learn this knowledge of good and evil by means of that tree and their choice. So there's a discerning wisdom there. You see that? They're either going to resist the influence and the temptation to go their own route, or they're going to take matters in their own hand, and they're going to then experience evil's destructive power. Do you realize that one does not have to practice evil to learn of its power? We sometimes think of that. Somebody has a shady past. We say, oh, they really know evil, but you grow up in Christian school, Christian home, you don't know anything about evil. Well, no. Sometimes the person who has resisted the influence may know evil's power all the more because they've resisted and not gone down that path. Jesus is the perfect example of that. He knows the full weight of temptation and evil, but never gave in to its seduction. Make sense? So it's you look at that in the garden, and it really is a test of faith for Adam and Eve. Will they make their choice based on God's defining of the situation of good and evil, or will they seek to define good and evil by themselves, you know, independent of God's word? If they define good and evil based on their thoughts and understandings and assumptions, then guess what happens? They become the source of truth. They're the definer of what's right and wrong, the time that it should be taken, and what I need to know and when I need to know it. They're the source of that. If they trust in God's definition of what is good and evil, then they live in harmony, shalom. This was God's intention. So does that make sense? As you look at that tree, it's really about self-dependent autonomy or a dependent childlike faith and trust. Our good friend Walter Brueggemann says it like this. This is really the question always, right? Who decides what is in the best interest of the human? You know, the tree and the command define the limits of creatureliness. To transgress those limits entails deciding about what one's own best interests are, to become autonomous, to become completely independent of the will of God for one's life. So hopefully that makes sense. Irenaeus was an early church father, 2nd century, and he brings up an interesting point, I think. He said, as we come to Genesis 2, you think of the Genesis narrative, and you think of this couple, Adam and Eve, as like full-blown adults, but maybe they were young adults. Maybe they were teenagers. Maybe they were kids in a prepubescent condition. So like, you picture childlike innocence. So the tree has prohibited them, not because of what it offers, not because that knowledge is bad, but because of timing, right? Think of driving, drinking, enlisting for the service, adult content, you know, sex. Not bad in and of themselves, but not appropriate for young kids or at an early age. Think of the temptations of Jesus. Satan offers him the kingdoms of this world, which were Christ's destiny anyway, but it wasn't the proper time, right? And Christ resists. So the essence of the evil one's temptation was getting Christ to bypass God's timing and his process and seize the world by another means, means other than God's intention. See? So if Irenaeus is right, then it was just not the right time for God to teach to give this knowledge about good and evil. God would begin training them at an appropriate time that was based on his knowledge, see, and not just man's whims. But we know the story. The humans break God's boundary. They exceed their limits. But I like Irenaeus' picture. It allows us to see that this has more to do with proper timing than with some inherent property in the tree. But does that make sense to you? That the basic truth is still the same. You're going to learn this knowledge of good and evil through obedience and trust or through disobedience and doubt. You're going to resist the influence of the tree and its temptation, or you're going to give in and take matters in your own hand and experience that destructiveness. But either way, the couple is going to come to know this knowledge of good and evil. Now, that's a great picture, isn't it? It's like you want to sit down and have some coffee with that dude. Every one of us faces limitations in our knowledge, right? Without exception. Am I right? Some of you don't seem convinced of that. All of us, just so you know, all of us have limitations in our knowledge. Okay. Albert Einstein, he even hit the wall of his limitations. He had a great mind that could push through to discover relativity theory, but he couldn't combine that with quantum theory into this big unified field theory. He searched for that all-encompassing theory for the rest of his life, but it eluded him. We all meet limitations in our ability to reason through things, to remember things, to reflect on things. As we age, unfortunately, this becomes even more apparent. We obviously, those senior moments are closer together. Our brains can only absorb and process so much. So whether you're sitting in trigonometry, algebra, calculus class in high school, or you're in a wheelchair in a nursing home, we have to face those limitations, those consequences. Now, before we eat, here's what I'm wondering about tonight. Are there any good consequences? Like, is there any comfort or consolation that comes from this dilemma of limits? Like, we could ask it like this. What gifts? Because right here tonight, nobody has 100% assurance about anything. You don't have 100% certainty. If you do, then you don't have faith, really. You don't need it. No one has about 100% certainty about anything. So what gifts do this limits of our knowledge afford us? And I think the most important thing, and something that we talk about here frequently, is that our ignorance offers us the freedom to be human. Now, we talk about that a lot, which Jesus Christ is fully human. We want to, in our Twitter or whatever, fully human living. I mean, that's a thing for us, fully human. That's our desires, that people live fully human lives. Now, when we say that, some people think, well, why do you need to say that? Like, what other choice do we have? Objectively speaking, we can't be anything other than human, right? What I'm saying, in that deep place inside of you where your desires and your longings shape you, there lives a craving that desires to be something other than human, something more than human. According to this passage, to be blunt, we want to be God, a know-it-all being who can control our own world. I would say the Genesis passage, if it's right, it says that there is this inherent God lust in us. This persuasive urge to throw off the constraints of our humanity and become God. It's in us. Now, a lot of people tonight, we have to be honest about the culture. A lot of people would look in on us and say, are you people serious? You're here gathered, and you're reading Genesis 2. Now, like, that was great for little kids in Sunday school to kind of make them moral and orderly. But have we not moved past this? Like, do we not know that the Bible is just these kind of ancient folk tales? We evolve and grow beyond that kind of thought process. What are you doing reading it like you're trying to live your life by that narrative? And I would say these great narratives that have endured for centuries in our collective consciousness, we ignore these stories at our great peril. These stories have to be looked into, or I would say looked through like windows that make possible a clearer view of what does it mean to be a human being in this world? What does it mean to be a human being in God's world? And I think we learn a lot if we take heed. Like one of the things that tells us right off the bat is that human beings are more, and how many people need to hear this in our world? Human beings are more than cosmic accidents in a universe of happenstance. You want to get down to the foundational narrative between the racial tension and conflict right here. Genesis brings you back and says, whoa, wait a minute. As you canvas the human situation, no matter how bad it looks, those people are part of something purposeful, something that has been endowed with great meaning. So you look out at society in all of its badness, and you look out and you say, there has been a great creator at work, and he has fashioned these rational, thoughtful, beautiful creatures. And he's given them responsibility. I mean, think of this, nothing less than this, responsibility to subdue the earth and have dominion. There's your task. Say that to yourself on Monday morning. I am called to subdue the earth and have dominion. I look great when you're applying for a job, right? But nothing less than that. And one of the ways that we have dominion is through naming. So did you catch this part of the story? It was really great. I love this. The story says that God after, so picture that in your mind, God forming and shaping the animals and birds, that he brings them before man to see what he would name them. Hello. Boy, fundamentalists don't bring that out very often. You've got this magnificent omnibeing who speaks galaxies into existence, and he gets done shaping and forming the animals and the birds and comes to man and includes man and says, be a co-creator alongside me. What would you name them? Friends, that's beautiful that God would come to our level and say, join me in this process. I remember being on a vacation. I'll say this. I think we love naming. Like most people like zoos. We like SeaWorld. At what point hasn't one of us wanted to be a marine biologist playing with dolphins all day? I did. Every time I see a dolphin movie, I want to go back to that. I remember being on a vacation where there were lots of windows and there were lots of trees and there was birds, and on the table of where we were staying was this book about identifying birds. So I decided to become an ornithologist on this vacation. But every time I saw a bird, I suddenly wanted to look it up in this book. And I think, why is that? Like, why do we not just want to look at the birds and their color and their movement? Why do we feel like, why do we need to know what it is and name it? And I would say woven into the fabric of our species is this very primitive need to discover, to learn, to name, and to catalog. Part of what it means to be a human is that you are a scientist always in search of knowledge. You're always trying to discover and name and explore and understand. But there are limitations and boundaries. And I think one of the ways you know, you go, okay, so is Genesis just this old ancient fable, or do we see it playing out in our lives? So there is reality to that story. For example, I think ringing in the ears of humankind is that phrase, you will be like God. The temptation that proved too enticing to deny was more than ripe fruit, no matter how beautiful or tasty it might have been. The really desirable, the impossible to resist seduction was that promise of a promotion. If you eat this fruit, You will gain knowledge that will make you more than human. You will be like God. So we read an ancient text like Genesis, and can we say this? The essential temptation, the foundation, you strip all the things and you get down to the root. The foundational snare of humanity, the story says, is to want to be something other than what we were created to be. To rise up and take God's place. Now, it was hard for Adam and Eve, I'm sure, to accept a limit to their knowledge. They wanted to know more than was allowed them at the moment. And I really do. I think that story shows, as we start this series, the central dilemma for the human condition, because you are made for learning. You are made for exploring and evolving and acquiring great knowledge, yet at the same time, you eventually come to a boundary that you pass over to your own undoing. To try and be God, to grasp at certainty, I would say that is the end of our humanity right there. To try and figure it out, I think, is to assume an impossible burden. And I can't tell you, so many people carry that burden. I would offer you there is lots of joy lacking in society because so many are carrying that burden. And they miss out on the gift that is offered by a boundary. There's a gift with uncertainty. There's a gift of not knowing. Excuse me. And that's the freedom to be what we were made to be, humans. Here's good news for me. We don't need to know everything to explain all things, to answer all questions, to solve all mysteries. We don't need to. We weren't called to. Many of us, though, are from the Scooby-Doo generation, right? I'd pay quite a bit of money to have that van, I gotta be honest. I'm a little kooky like that. The Mystery Machine. We think we're the Mystery Machine. You might think of every Scooby-Doo episode that you have ever seen. Starts out what? With a mystery, an unknown factor, an enchanted world. There's some haunted mansion, and they're being chased by some ghost or goblin, and all of them are terrified because they're vulnerable to this unknown, to these spiritual forces that are at work. And at some point, Shaggy runs away screaming, and Scooby follows him. Shaggy? That's pretty good Scooby-Doo with the cold, right? And he follows him. And then the turn comes, and the ghost or monster overplays its hand, and these detective kids suddenly realize that it wasn't a ghost at all. And so you have this moment where there's the great unmasking, where they pull back the disguise, and sure enough, what we find is there are no mysteries left in the world. It's just old Mr. Dickerson, the greedy banker, trying to get rich. And it always ends with saying, and I would have got away with it if it wasn't for those meddling kids. Right? And so as a generation, we learned there are no mysteries left in the world. Many people coming up with such knowledge at their fingertips, they don't even know of anything other than that. We're a lot like that Mystery Machine where we go around, we think, man, if I went to this school, if I went to this church, if I studied under this person, if I went to this conference, if I read this book, if I could find this on the internet, I'd figure it out. I'd have some kind of 100% certainty. And friends, I gotta be honest, to be human is to want to do those things. And part of our glory is to do these things as fully as possible, as far as we are able, right up to the edge of the boundary. See? But that inevitable limitation to knowing reminds us that we are not God, that there are things that are just simply beyond our comprehension. So whatever you accomplish in life, whatever height you may ascend to, our limited knowledge tells us this. You are humans. That's okay. That's good. That's what you were created to be. And part of your glory is to keep scratching and searching and learning and evolving. But part of our glory is to accept that there are things that are beyond us and we are surrounded by mysteries before which we can only bend the knee in awe, which leaves space for worship, calls you to worship. So many in this day, oh, I don't need to gather with people to mind me. They got stuff on the internet. I can watch N.T. Wright, and I can read all these. But you can, absolutely. And you can learn a lot, and you can probably be a great Christian. But we gather because there's this posture of humility that is so needed still in this culture that says, we don't have it figured out. We're still sometimes a mess with what we know. We need each other, and sometimes all we can do is just sing and clap our hands and trust that it's good. You know? So hopefully tonight, before we go eat pizza, hopefully we all can joyfully affirm at the beginning of this series that ignorance is a necessary part of being human. Right? Some have said, wow, I've always wanted him to say that. Yeah? Now, it doesn't mean our high calling is shoved to the side and we just all become intellectual couch potatoes that you never open the New York Times and attempt to do the crossword puzzle anymore because, you know, ignorance. But let's be honest, ignorance is a precondition for some of the most important discoveries, right? Those who already know the truth, we know those kind of people, those who already know the truth, they may not be open enough to receive its new appearances, its new revelations. So I'm saying, those who possess knowledge and they comprehend all things, they might not ever be empty enough to receive new manifestations. Everybody knew that the earth was flat. You know, for 14 centuries, scholars accepted the theory that the earth was the motionless center of the universe, and then came along a doubting Copernicus who was open enough to imagine a different scenario, and he laid the foundation for modern astronomy. Significant learning is always preceded by someone saying, well, I don't know about that. Any teacher will tell you that the most difficult students, right, are the ones who know it all. The ones most likely to learn, to advance, are those who have this teachable ignorance. That's a good question. Are you teachable? Is there a hungry emptiness in you? Is there a willing receptivity to new, to change? It wasn't exactly what you assumed. Because friends, only in the darkness can you see the stars. You look out at something like that. I mean, Rob's here tonight visiting. We were in Ukraine once. You remember we sat on a mountain scene. It wasn't quite that. I enhanced that a little bit, but it wasn't quite like that, but it was similar. And there's really nothing to do in the face of that except worship. Because you look at that, and there's got to be somebody to thank. You know? That's what the heart longs for. There are things that cannot be grasped, no matter how great your intellectual prowess. And here's a key for tonight, because this affects the rest of the series. There are things that only can be received. So there is a knowledge that cannot be gained by thinking and reasoning and deducing and experimenting and theorizing. Because it's a knowledge that comes to us, not from us, and it can only be acknowledged with gratitude and surprise when it appears in an open heart. Think of the women that encountered the resurrection scene. Did they jump in the mystery machine and say, wow, this can't be, we got to figure this out, there's some explanation for this? No. The only thing to do was to fall on the ground in devotion and worship. And as paradoxical to me as it sounds, we can only prepare for that kind of knowledge, to receive that knowledge, by encountering the limits of our knowledge. Does that make sense? I know it sounds a little bit like a fortune cookie, but you can only prepare to receive that knowledge that comes from outside of us by encountering the limits of your knowledge. Because those limitations remind you of your humanity. They remind you of your station in life. They remind you of your ignorance, and what that does is stir up awe and wonder inside of you, and that is necessary for encountering the deepest, most soul-shaping truths. So you've got to come to those limits. When you come to those limits, that then stirs the awe and wonder that are necessary for those truths that are really going to change your life. If there's anything I could say as we go into these thoughts over the next couple of weeks here into the fall, I think it might be this, that you and I cannot be fully human without reverence. Part of being human is reverence. However much you might learn, you never graduate for the need for quiet reverence. I'd say, you look out at the ills of society and you see a group, a generation coming up, and there's good things about, like, we tend to always go, oh, look at all the bad things. Our generation was so much better because we walked barefoot in the snow, blah, blah, blah. I always think, no, your generation had its own stinking problems. This generation has its own problem. This generation has really great things about it. This one had good things about it. Let's see both. But if we look to the ills of this generation, this could be one of them. A lack of reverence because I've always had everything I thought I needed at my fingertips. Never known anything else. There isn't this sense of quiet reverence, childlike wonder, and considerate respect for the things around us, whether that be spider web. For Bruce and I this week on our office, it was a beautiful grasshopper. That sounds so right, grasshopper. I called Bruce down from the steps because there was a grasshopper on our window. And man, the intricate drawings on that dude, I was just amazed for a moment. The wonder of our beings, the incomprehensibility of God, it is in those in-between places that we have this respectful openness. And when you do, you may hear voices speaking truth to you that you may never have figured out all by yourself. It's in that open stance and that state of wonder that all of a sudden truth comes in. So here's how we end. I like that image. Standing in the shade of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you have a choice. We can take matters into our own hand and pluck the fruit and do our best to storm the throne of heaven. Or there's this posture of humility, knowing we do not know. We are creatures dependent upon a creator, that there are whole universes of reality that may exist beyond our powers of perception. But we know that for the time being, we exist on the edge of a vast mystery. And so we say this prayer, God, help me to see the good in the not knowing, the joy in the in-between, and the meaning in the meantime. Would you say that with me? God, help me to see the good in the not knowing, the joy in the in-between, the meaning in the meantime. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, you are good to include us in your life, and we gather here on Sundays to celebrate the joy of the resurrection and the power that is at work in us. And we come from a busy week, sometimes tired, sometimes exhausted from the to-do list. But we stop, and we do. We do these simple things like we sing some songs, and we come to the table and taste the bread and the wine. And we open up these ancient tales, and we try to place ourselves in the story and figure out who we are in light of you. So help us over these next couple weeks, we enter into some strange territory of thinking about uncertainty and not knowing and questions and doubts and what really is faith. And if God is really there, then why does he seem so quiet and hidden? And we can't think our way through this, but we just want to open up space to explore this. I know there are people here that are wrestling with those issues. I think at times all of us in life, we face a death of a loved one. We come to the end, and we realize that sometimes there's just nothing to say. There's silence, and there's all. And we do feel like people who have maybe lost some of the childlike wonder with this beautiful world that you've given us, and we don't want all of our devices and our cubicles and all the things that we find so necessary to steal that kind of wonder and insight. And so we ask that you help us to restore it as we talk about these things, as we sing, as we come to this table. And it is in your great name we pray. Amen.